You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
And pitches. Belton! Deep left field. That goes Rayburn and Bond. Billy Bumper.
Calls it one strike here to Butler.
Every time or two, lost my way in selfish, broken things. But when we take it to the Badlands, searching for the sun.
Another fine edition of the Pine Tar Podcast, where we talk about Billy Butler's 900 feet of home runs over the weekend, which were pretty fun. Before we'll talk about that first, and then we will get to a couple guests. Jim Callis of MLB.com will join us a little bit later in the show. Prior to that, we will talk to Keith Elkins, who is the Lexington Legends broadcaster, as well as Chris Lewis, who's the Idaho Falls broadcaster. So there's three interviews here coming up. We're going to talk for just a little bit. And so let me bring in Mr. Clint Scholes so we can get right to it. Clint, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm glad to see my favorite player is off the schneid and hitting mammoth home runs. And then, those were awesome, Dave. Those were fun to watch. It was very entertaining. But that double on Sunday might have been like
down the biggest, right field line.
Yeah, that might have been the biggest click to me that, hey, he might be back actually, because that was a Billy Butler swing. That was a pitch was low and away, and he took it the other way, donked it off the wall with some good, pretty good thud, and that was impressive.
Yeah, I'm hesitant because.
Oh, I'm hesitant too, but those three swings were good.
There have been times this year that he hit that opposite field home run earlier this year, and he's gotten a couple opposite field doubles that I looked at and I thought, that's Billy Butler's music, you know, and it never came to fruition. So hopefully, he'd be a big quote unquote acquisition if the Royals could get him going. It's interesting because there's a lot of people who talk about Billy Butler, lost cause, get rid of him, do whatever you can. It's not that simple. I know that you can't just put arbitrary endpoints on things, but I'm going to do it anyway because, you know, it's our podcast and I can do whatever I want on it. And Billy Butler's season line is not impressive. There's no doubt about that. He is hitting 273, 326 on base, and 370 slugging percentage. You look at that, that is not good enough. It's good for a 92 OPS plus. It's not okay. But you look a little bit deeper. And take a jaunt with me down the season's path. And you kind of look at certain sample sizes. And I take a look from game 14 on. You might say, well, why game 14? That's the day he got dropped in the lineup to sixth, if you recall, early in the season. He hit there for three games. But one for three that day. And ever since then, I'll preface this. He still hasn't been good enough, but it's better than you probably think. He's a 291 hitter, 342 on base, and 402 slugging percentage. Again, not enough, but much better. And then you kind of dig a little bit deeper, and you go, let's call it May 1st, because that season's first month is a good stopping point. Ever since then, he's hit 291 with a 341 on base percentage and a 411 slugging percentage. And the final sample that I want to look at is the day Dale Swaim took over, May 29th. And from that point on, this is where it gets interesting. Butler has been a 312 hitter with a 360 on-base percentage and a 441 slugging percentage. So my point here is not that Billy Butler is good or baseball god or immune from criticism, but that maybe he's not quite as bad as people think he has been. In that sample, since Dale Swaim took over, the 162-game average has him at 39 doubles and 13 homers, which, again, not good enough. I get it. but just not terrible like people think. Those first 13 games, man, they just destroyed Butler. And I was looking on FanGraphs at his batted ball information, and everything except for one number is pretty much in line with his 2012 season, and it's home runs for fly ball. And the issue is simple. He had no power. He wasn't driving anything. And then Friday and Saturday, he hit those two absolutely mammoth home runs. And that, to me, that's why I almost look at that and I think, all right, everything was lining up the way it always has for Billy Butler, but he had no power. And now all of a sudden he's hitting a ball 430 feet. Is the power back? If the power's back, Butler's back.
Oh, I agree. And those were mammoth home runs. That double was a shot down the right field line. It looks good. And what I tweeted out after that, and what I even tweeted out prior to his first home run, that, man, it would be nice if 2012 Butler would come back for this. And sure enough, boom, he hits it out. And
what was your favorite part about that home run? Because I have two.
You know, just the absolute distance and then the way he watched it, obviously.
See, I love the way he watched it. But my two favorite parts were first the bat flip and then the glare into the Royals dugout. He gave a look into the Royals dugout that was basically like, you bench me again, I kill you.
Well, Rex said it perfectly. That was a grudge home run.
Yep.
Is what he said. And
he earned the benching. Let's be real.
Yeah.
But he took that personally. And I was on 810 with TJ Carpenter earlier tonight before recording this podcast here on Monday night. And we talked a little bit about this. And TJ liked the idea that the Royals, or that Billy Butler was frustrated. He saw that as a positive. And as long as Billy Butler is channeling that frustration into positive results, I hope the Royals piss him off every day the rest of the season. Now, if his bad season that he had, if the season that he's had to date is due to him being frustrated, then him being frustrated is not a good thing. Because obviously it's led to subpar results. So we'll see. We'll see if his frustration can lead to him just having a monster final 2 months, because that would be huge. That would be absolutely huge, because if, you know, the Royals are one of many, 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 many teams looking to acquire help on their offense. And there are like three or four players available. So even if the Royals do everything in their power to acquire an impact bat, or even a so-called impact bat, they still might not get it done through no fault of their own. And that makes Billy Butler having a comeback for August and September, that makes that even more important. If he can just channel somewhere in between 2013 and 2012, then the Royals will be in much better shape.
No, if the Royals are competing with the Blue Jays, the Yankees, and the Mariners right now. And I guess the Tigers, you can include them too.
Yeah.
But they're five back. That's going to be a big hill to climb, especially considering they don't play the Tigers a ton left.
They play them six more times.
Yeah.
So that's probably 1-5 based on the way they played them this year.
Well, that, and I mean, to gain that ground, you got to go, 4-2 and have some help? Really, you can't even really go 4-2. You got to go at least 5-1,
and maybe 6-0 even.
Yeah, to gain ground on them.
Yep.
So they're going to need some help. So really, they're competing with Toronto, the Yankees, and the Mariners. Well, what they do better than those teams is play defense. They play significantly better defense. I think other than the Mariners, they probably have a better pitching staff than Toronto and the Yankees. And they probably have a better offense than the Mariners. How much better? Well, if Billy Butler's in 2012 form, they probably have a pretty significant better offense than the Mariners. Mm-hmm. And they're not the Yankees or Blue Jays offense, but they're so much better defensively that those teams, I think that they can kind of counterbalance it, and they have a much better schedule down the stretch than those teams. So the Royals need some help from other teams. Obviously, Detroit can help them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In that Detroit plays those teams quite a bit this month, this next month coming up. But if Billy Butler is 2012 Billy Butler, then this team has enough as it stands to get to the postseason.
Yeah, probably so. Well, something interesting happened before we started recording was the Royals made a deal today. They traded Danny Valencia, actually, to one of those teams they're chasing. They traded him to the Blue Jays in exchange for catcher Eric Kratz and pitcher Liam Hendricks, who you may remember from his days with the Twins. Fun fact about Liam Hendricks, I assumed based on his name for the longest time that he was left-handed, and it turns out he's not. So there's that. With that move, the Royals DFA'd Brett Hayes, so Eric Kratz is now the Royals' backup catcher. He's a big right-handed hitter with a lot of power and not much else. I think he rates pretty well defensively, though, so might be a little bit better fit as a backup. Hendricks will go to AAA to replace Valencia on the roster. The Royals have called up Mr. Christian Colon, who's been raking, and we'll talk about him a little bit later on the podcast. So that's kind of the deal. It's interesting that they've traded a guy who can help a club ahead of them.
Well, I guess if he can help them, but it's a give and a take. If I think a lot of the part of this deal was that Danny Valencia probably it wasn't a fit within the clubhouse would be my guess.
Yeah, there's been some issues with Valencia throughout his tenure in the big league, so that wouldn't surprise me much. And I think, and also before we started recording, Jerry Krasnick of ESPN.com tweeted that the Royals had interest in A.J. Pierzynski as a backup catcher before he signed with the Cardinals, which, quick side note, is A.J. Pierzynski signing with the Cardinals like the most A.J. Pierzynski thing ever?
Pretty much.
But so the Royals clearly weren't thrilled with Brett Hayes' work behind the plate as a backup catcher, and they shouldn't have been. So they were looking for a backup catcher. They had an opportunity to get that by dealing Danny Valencia, and Dayton Moore mentioned that he really wanted to get Christian Colon on the big league roster. Now, why he had to trade a player to do that, I don't really understand, considering he has a 42-year-old quote-unquote outfielder on his roster who doesn't hit much, but That's another question for another day. So, yeah, that's kind of the roster moves of the day. And, yeah, we're getting close to the trade deadline, and I wrote about this morning the option. So maybe we'll see some more moves here in the next couple of days.
Well, it's an interesting note that they go with Colon. They're going – you assume they're going to continue to platoon Moustakas. So now against left-handers – Christian Colon is going to be in your lineup, probably playing third base. In a wild card chase, in a playoff chase, you're going to be starting a rookie every day. That's a pretty interesting move when you need to supplement your offense somewhat.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I would bet that Alcides Escobar actually gets a day or two off.
That's another move. I mean, he's struggled some to start the second half. So, but I think you significantly weaken your defense then.
You do. You absolutely do. But at the same time, I mean, look what Escobar did in that first series back after the break. He was
abysmal. It was
a disaster. And you wonder, does he need some time off? Is playing every day for the last 4 years, did that come back to bite him? And maybe it did. Maybe he's a guy who you want to play 145 games instead of 158 games.
They should lessen his workload a little bit. I mean,
yeah,
145 probably isn't the best, but you know, it wouldn't hurt the guy to play 150, 155.
Right. I mean, it doesn't have to be 145, yeah. But yeah,
give him a few extra days off. It's just interesting that little quick tidbit of Colon, and Colon the last 40 games has really been on a tear, and so maybe the Royals feel that he's made the adjustments that need to get him some regular playing time. And let's face it, Danny Valencia played in, what, 30-some games, 32, 36-some games for the Royals?
Yeah,
he's not the best clubhouse guy, if you remember from his days with the Twins and some of the things that were rumored around there. So it's not a bad move. He really hasn't worked out for the Royals and how you wanted him to do. I mean,
he had 119 at-bats, and it's, what are they, 104 games into the season?
Yeah, and last year he only played 52 games. But in those 52 games, he really put up some pop. I mean, he had an OPS of .888 and had 8 home runs in that time. But you're just asking a lot of a guy to repeat those numbers. It's just not going to work. And So this way, you get a good player in Cologne that can play some shortstop. Infante still needs days off, so he can play some second. Moustakas needs days off. This is why I liked Emilio Bonifacio on this roster. And yeah, Bonifacio's come back down to life, you know, back down to regularity of what you expect. But he just could play so many positions. And Danny Valencia just couldn't do that. And it just wasn't a good fit. So hopefully Christian Colón, this is, he's not going to be this player, what he showed in his time, but hopefully he's getting to be better than what he exhibited in his minor league career.
Well, I mean, here's the thing about Colón, and this is all we know for certain. He has a 1,000 OPS in the big leagues.
He's got near that over his last 40 games, big leagues and minor league games.
True, very true, very true. Now, neither of us are the biggest Christian Colón fans, but you know, for minimum salary, if he can be a super utility guy, I think that's a really good use of a roster spot.
No, it is, and you've probably upgraded a catcher. Kratz might not be that great, but he's probably an upgrade over Hayes.
Yeah, I mean, Hayes, you know, the 362 OPS, he has a minus one OPS plus this year.
Yeah, that's not
good. I've heard some rumblings, nothing that I would put a name on or really talk about too deeply, but I've heard some rumblings that pitchers aren't in love with throwing to him either.
Yeah, I'm not going to blame the guy. You get so much limited time. I mean,
right. I don't think part of it. Here's the thing: when you have Salvador Perez behind the plate, you got that big target. I wouldn't want to throw to Brett Hayes either.
That's true, but then again, if you maybe pitchers need to look a little bit deeper because the metrics on Sal's framing is not that good.
Yeah, true. That's very true. So,
but hopefully Kratz will be an upgrade there, and hopefully Liam Hendricks can find something in the minors. But I think this is a good time, Dave, for us to take our first break.
I agree.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
We'll start with the breaking news here. That's happened literally just minutes before we went on air. Yep, it's coming over across the wire. So the Royals, in a trade sure to just turn this season completely around, have sent Danny Valencia, third base platoon extraordinaire, to Toronto for pitcher Liam Hendricks, who is in AAA right now, and apparently, from what I understand, will be sent to AAA in Omaha. And then along with that, they got, what's the guy's name, Mike?
Eric Kratz.
Eric Kratz.
That's a good sign when you can't remember other guys.
Yes, yes. So Kratz is a catcher, no doubt meant to be a backup catcher. Brett Hayes was designated for assignment. Mike, give me your first impressions from this here.
My first impression was, huh?
Royals Podcast Network.
We take a brief spin around the minor leagues in the Royals organization. First up, Keith Elkins, Director of Broadcasting for Lexington Legends. Hey, Keith, how's it going?
Going well, Glenn. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah. Keith, you've got an interesting squad, full season squad down there. What's kind of been the storyline with the Legends this year?
Well, the Legends have run into some problems occasionally with pitching inconsistencies and, of course, just the other things that the young players run into sometimes in terms of making a mistake during a ball game. So it's been a rather rough go here in the second half. They broke an 8-game losing streak just last night with a 1-0 win, a real good ball game there. But, of course, there have been some bright spots along the way, too. But right now they are more or less out of contention in the Southern Division race in the second half. They're 14.5 games behind Asheville, which has had a terrific start in the second half. So standings-wise, it doesn't look so good, but in terms of player development, there are guys who have made some improvements, and, of course, that's what the Royals are looking for. So all in all, it's been a good group to watch, and we've still got a lot of baseball yet to be played.
Last year, obviously, you had big names, Bubba Starling, Raul Mondesi, and a few others that came through there. Who have been the big guys to watch this year for the Legends?
Well, our South Atlantic League midseason all-stars were Dominic Taylor, an outfielder, and Frank Swindell, catcher, first baseman, and they're both having good years, although Taylor has been hurt here the last few weeks. He had a groin injury that has kept him out since late June. He just made a rehab assignment, first game last night in Burlington, and got a couple of hits. So it looks like he may be on his way back. But those guys are both having really good years for the Legends. Carlos Garcia has had a good year. He hasn't been a full-time player all along, although he has played in 59 games now. But a .279 average. He leads the team in stolen bases with 19. He's doing a great job with runners in scoring position, switch hitter. And since the promotion of Ramon Torres to Wellington earlier this year, Carlos has gotten a little bit more of a chance to play, and he has done very well. Mauricio Ramos has had a great second half. His batting average right at the 300 mark now, and he was out with a hand injury earlier this year, missed about 3 weeks back in April and early May, but has come on real strong since then, had a 340 month in the month of June. And he's played well at third base, too. So he's having a good year as well. So those three guys come to mind immediately as having a good year for the Legends here in 2014. And pitching-wise, Jake Junis has been the most consistent. He's now 8-5, his ERA at 3.27, but he's made 20 starts. He's pitched 111 innings and has been real dependable for the Legends this year. And he's kind of led the way on that pitching staff.
You mentioned breaking the losing streak last night. That was backed up by a great starting performance by Pedro Fernandez, his first really solid effort this year. What do you see in him?
There's a lot of potential there. In fact, I talked with Frank Schwindel after the game last night. He drove in the game's only run. He was on with us in postgame, and he said they were kind of joking before the game that Fernandez must be the best 0-6 pitcher in the league, and that's kind of what we had seen, too. He just make a mistake or maybe walk a couple of guys and somehow would have to pay for it in each of his appearances there. And the six decisions had gone against him before last night. But last night he put everything together and just had a great game, allowed one hit through six innings. They were just not getting to him at all. And the Legends came through with the one run in the sixth just in time for him to get the victory. So he's on the board now with that victory. I'm sure there'll be a lot more to come from Pedro Fernandez. Everybody likes this guy and thinks that he has a whole lot of talent. He has what I would call, I guess what a lot of people, baseball people would call a live arm, and he certainly can get it up there quickly and is improving with the other pitches. And last night was just a real eye-opener, I think, for Pedro Fernandez, and we'll hope that builds some momentum for him going forward.
One other name, real briefly, if you could tell us about him, is Alfredo Escalar Maldonado. He's kind of opened some eyes this year with some flashes out there, showing some pop and showing some hitting ability and playing some defense. What do you like about his game?
I think he's been very steady for the Legends this year. He's got 11 steals. He's been in that leadoff spot most of the year and is very dependable in center field, a very dependable outfielder, and continues to make improvement. I would have to think the Royals are pretty satisfied with his progress this year, and it's been fun to watch him play. I'm just looking over his numbers here, 13 doubles, 3 triples, 8 homers now. He's been showing some power here over the last few weeks. He had a little setback a couple of weeks ago, has been out because of an appendectomy, but he is back with the ball club now. And I asked him yesterday just real briefly how he was doing, and he said better. So I took that to mean he's still got a little bit of a ways to go before he is able to get back on the field and compete at 100%. But up until that time that happened, he had continued to make progress, and he has really been a good one to watch this year, and I think he's on his way.
He's a pretty impressive kid off the field as well, as far as his donations to some causes and earning an actual award from President Obama. That, what's it like dealing with the players off the field?
Well, I think Alfredo especially is just an outstanding individual. He has mentioned a couple of times in interviews with me that being Puerto Rican, he looks up to Roberto Clemente and his life and what he accomplished and how he was always giving back. And, of course, Alfredo comes from a baseball family, and so they have kind of made an effort to make him familiar with Clemente, and he said a relative of his had given him a DVD on Clemente's career and life, and so he tries to model himself after someone like Roberto Clemente, who continues to influence people now 40 years after his death. And so it's interesting to hear him say that that's an important focus in his life. So he does seem to be a great individual off the field, and he also has helped me on a number of occasions do some interviews with our Spanish-speaking players, the guys who are still kind of coming along with their English. And Alfredo, of course, can shift back and forth from Spanish to English without a problem at all, conversing in both languages. And has helped me out as a translator on a number of occasions, and that helps me get to know the other guys a little bit better, too. So he's just been a great guy to have on the team, and we'll look forward to seeing him back in uniform and on the field very soon.
Then last question, kind of the main power source year in for the entire year has been Frank Schwindel, who you mentioned earlier. Frank, 15 home runs, 26 doubles, two triples. What's his status as far as playing behind the dish? Is that something that you think he could be a regular catcher in the big leagues?
Well, I think you would have a ways to go before you would arrive at that assessment. But a guy works at and continues to improve, and nobody works any harder than Frank at that position. It's a very difficult position to move into, as you know, and you have to be a leader on the field. You got to call the games, and it's just a very tough position to play. But he's accepted that challenge, and he continues to get better, I think. And that's the arc that you're looking for is a continuous improvement, and he has worked to do that. So, and it would certainly be a big boost to his career, I think, if he can make the successful transition. One thing that I've had a chance to talk with him a number of times about is that he doesn't let the challenges of catching get to his hitting. He's been productive in games that he has been behind the plate, and he seems to be able to have the mental self-discipline to let that go when he steps up to the plate. So I'll say that he works hard, continues to improve, and for a guy who hasn't caught a whole lot, he's doing a good job. And pitchers will often say that after a good ball game, that Frank has called a good game. So he's working well with the pitchers, and that's a big part of it too.
Oh, certainly it is. Keith, thanks for joining us. You can listen to Keith on MILB.com or watch the Legends on MILB.TV. Thanks again, Keith, for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Glenn. Thanks for having me. I hope you're doing well, and thanks again for having me on today.
From Lexington, we head over to Idaho Falls and bring in Chris Lewis, Idaho Falls Chucker announcer. Chris, thanks for joining the show.
Hey, thank you for the time. I've heard a few of these podcasts. I'm glad to be on.
Well, thank you very much. Chris, obviously short season ball, but the Royals without a complex league seem to be carrying a lot more players. I like to be able to have to pay attention to so many players on and off the Chuckers roster.
It seems like with getting rid of the Arizona League team, it's just like more players for one fewer team. So you just have to keep up to date with a lot more. And there's been a lot of player movement, I noticed, too, this year compared to last year. Like, for example, we have a player in we had a player here in Logan Davis who not only played here in Idaho Falls, he's played in Advanced A Wilmington this year, also Double A Northwest Arkansas, also Triple A Omaha. And I think he just left us today, and I don't know where he's going. It just goes to show you, he's probably the prime example of, there's a lot of movement here in the Royals system with dropping the Arizona League team and just having one fewer team to host the same amount, if not more, players.
One of those players that's kind of tore up the league is 2014 draftee Ryan O'Hearn. What have you seen out of him?
He's a monster at the plate. For the first half of the year, he's been pretty much the league MVP in a runaway. I mean, the way he's hitting, top of the league in average, he's top five in the league in homers, he's been top five in the league in runs batted in, he's top three in the league in slugging. So, like, any offensive category you like to measure players, and I know this time of baseball, everybody has their own type of certain measurement that they like to evaluate offensive players with, but O'Hearn would be at the top of that list. First baseman who was billed as mainly a line drive hitter heading in from Sam Houston State. I think one thing that's helped him here making that adjustment is he has one of his college teammates in Corey Tubes, another 2014 Royals draft choice, on this Idaho Falls team with him. So he already had that sort of comfort. And from the first game, he was 5-for-5 in his first game that he played here in Idaho Falls. In his first at-bat, he had a home run. So it just goes to show you, this league's been pretty kind to him so far. Hopefully he can keep that up in half, too.
Guys, they got off to kind of a slow start to start the season, but they came on towards the second half, that second part of that first half. What do you expect in the second half for this team?
Well, if it's based on anything like last year, when Idaho Falls at bat had probably the worst start to the season amongst any team in the league, and they ended up playing well to end the first half and winning the second half in route to winning a championship. So I kind of like that formula, so why don't we try to keep that up? But now I really think that this team offensively has the capability to be there with any team in this league if the Pioneer League. The ball flies out of pretty much every ballpark here. So it's high scoring. Like the average game here is basically 8-7. It's unlike most other levels of baseball. So a lot of the teams have the offense. It's all about pitching, and Suckers have had on and off pitching throughout towards the second half of the first half of the year. The pitching's been better, and if that pitching can keep up, then the second half should be pretty good.
Another player that lit it up in a short time, and I don't know if he encountered an injury or if he's just fallen victim to others getting some playing time, but Wander Franco, the 19-year-old Dominican, really tore it up in his 19-game stint there. What's the status with him?
Yeah, well, to begin his time here in Idaho Falls, he's been dealing with a shoulder injury. He's actually a switch hitter, but he's been limited to only batting right-handed. And at this point, when you put up the numbers that he's putting, why are you going to try to start switch hitting again? Because hitting above 400, I sort of like that. But, yeah, he's been battling that shoulder injury, so he didn't play the first couple of weeks of the year. But when he was inserted, he was producing. And then about a week and a half ago, he went back to Kansas City to get his shoulder again checked out to make sure it's okay. So he left the team for about a week. And now, yesterday, in fact, he played his first game in about 9 days. So he came in as a pinch hitter and took the place of the designated hitter who was starting that game and had a single and an RBI. So, yeah, he's been pretty amazing. He had a torrid stretch where he was the Pioneer League Player of the Week right after O'Hearn was named the Player of the Week, where he hit, like, above 450, where he had a couple of homers mixed in, a couple of triples, a bunch of doubles. So he's another guy who uses all the parts of the field, and he's been pretty productive when he's had a chance to hit.
You mentioned the struggles of the pitchers. 2011 draftee, second round pick Brian Brickhouse coming back from Tommy John surgery. How's he looked?
He's been pretty good. It's been an interesting season for him because he started opening day here in Idaho Falls in 2012. He kind of got hit hard against the Orioles, and then he was basically called up right after that start to, at that time, Kane Cowdy, who was the low A affiliate. At that time for Kansas City. So then he had a season in Lexington, had to deal with that Tommy John surgery injury. So now he's back in Idaho Falls working and trying to get back. He was also the opening day starter this season. And his pattern has been early on in the season, just a couple of innings, that he's been able to work it up as many as four. He had one start where he started to feel a little bit more discomfort, so they sort of set him back and wanted to make sure they didn't overwork him. So he started just having a couple of two-inning outings, and he's trying to build himself back up again. As far as his effectiveness, it's been there. Again, this is a really tough league for pitchers. You really have to keep the ball down because high altitude all across the league, the ball flies out the park. So it's really a challenge to get that confidence. But I think Brickhouse, being one of the more veteran players on this team, sort of gets it.
Who, you talked with the player development guys in the Royals organization. Who are some of the pitchers that they highlight on this team?
Well, you take a look at Eric Skoglund, who third-round draft pick of this most recent draft for Kansas City, and I think they think really highly of him, and why wouldn't you? He's 6'7", 200-pound lefty from University of Central Florida, very lanky guy, but he throws hard. And I think that Kansas City thinks very highly of him. And another guy who I think they've had their eye on is Jake Newberry. He was a very late draft pick, in fact, 37th round, way back in 2012. But he's really put up good numbers wherever he's been, Burlington, now here in Idaho Falls. He's really shown up and pitched very well. So I think he's catching the eyes of a lot of the player development guys, and they think, hey, we may have gotten a steal in the late 30 rounds of the draft back in 2012 because Jake Newberry's shown every bit of capability that these high-round draft choices have.
Well, like you mentioned, the Chuckers took off last year, ended up winning the Pioneer League title. And today's the start of the second half, so Chris, I hope you enjoy that. People can follow you, what, at Chris Lewis Tweet on Twitter?
That's absolutely the case, at Chris Lewis Tweet. I can't promise you that I'm going to tweet that many Kansas City Royals things, but you'll definitely get your Chuckers news and maybe some Boise State and other Idaho things mixed in.
All right, well, thanks a lot. Hopefully we talk to you later in the season.
All right, would love to. Thanks for having me.
That was a quick spin around the Royals minor league system. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with Jim Keller.
Hello. Do you know us? We're a Major League Baseball podcast. But since our team hasn't won a pennant in nearly 30 years, nobody recognizes us, not even in our hometown. And that's why you should listen to the Pine Tar Podcast, because no matter how far out of first the Royals are, it's cool. You know, it'll keep you from getting shut out at your favorite hotels and restaurant-type places. So, if you're looking for some...
David, this is going to be a copyright infringement on Major League.
Oh, well, just listen to the Pine Tar Podcast then, starring Clint Scholes and David Leskin.
We are now joined by Jim Callis from MLB.com. He handles draft prospects and all sorts of other things. So we're lucky to have him. Jim, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing good. Glad to be here with you guys.
Let's jump right in. We want to talk a little Astros with you because that's kind of a hot topic in the draft right now. Obviously, they did not get Brady Aiken signed, and that kind of led to the domino effect where other picks did not get signed. Can you just kind of explain what exactly happened there?
Yeah, I don't know if I can make this especially short, but I'll give you the most concise version. You know, so Brady Aiken goes number one in the draft, and 2 days after the draft, he agrees to terms for a $6.5 million bonus that's contingent on passing a post-draft school, which is – we get more into that. But it's not – the Astros didn't do anything unusual there. It's just the way baseball has this set up is horribly backwards, and it leads to problems. In the interim, they also agreed to terms with their fifth-round pick, Jacob Nix, another high school pitcher from California, for $1.5 million. And, you know, as I'm sure or a lot of your listeners probably know, the way that the draft system works now is each team is assigned a bonus pool for the first 10 rounds. And you can spend the money as you see fit, but if you go over your bonus pool by more than 5%, you start to lose draft picks. And the catch is you can spend money as you see fit, but if you don't sign a pick, his money disappears. So Brady Aiken's draft slot was worth about $8 million, just under $8 million. So anyway, so he agrees to terms on the 7th. On the 23rd, he goes to Houston to take physical, and he takes physical. And according to Evan Drellich from the Houston Chronicle, who's the only one who's had the real details of this, there was something with his ulnar collateral ligament in his elbow. Not a tear, but it's abnormally small. I don't know if that means it's thinner, it's shorter, what have you. The Astros are concerned about this. You know, and it's one of these things, I don't think there's a lot of track record as to what that means, but there's, you know, I guess in the Astros' opinion or the opinion of their doctor, you know, it could mean it's more likely to tear. It'd be harder to repair, perhaps. You know, it's murky. So anyway, he fails the physical. So the Astros, at that point, reduce their offer to Brady Aiken, because in order to get compensation for not signing him, if they don't sign him, they have to offer him 40% of his pick value, which is just under $3.2 million. So they make him that offer. And, you know, then it's kind of quiet. Nobody really kind of knows what's going on. About a week later, there's word that there might be something with the physical. Nobody's really sure what's going on. Then the details come out a week after that, that there's something with the UCL. And then leading up to the final week before the deadline, on, I can't remember if it was the Monday or Tuesday before the Friday line, Casey Close, who's the advisor for both Nix and Brady Aiken, charges the Astros with trying to, I guess, manipulate the physical process and save money in their bonus pool so they could sign Aiken and Nix and their 21st round pick, Mac Marshall, who would have been a top 3 round guy, and he's going to probably take at least $1.5 million to sign. So Casey Close comes out and charges that. The Astros don't say a lot and say, look, we're not going to play games with the number one pick. Come down to the final. The Astros reach out 2 or 3 times, eventually raise their offer to a little bit over $5 million, get no response from Aiken or the Aiken family or the advisors, and don't sign Brady Aiken. Now, going back to the math portion of this, they don't sign Brady Aiken, so his $8 million disappears from their bonus pool. As a result, with that $8 million gone, if they sign Jacob Nix for $1.5 million, then that will put them more than 15% over their bonus pool without Aiken's money there to kind of, you know, make the bigger, in which case they would lose their first two or their next two first-round picks, which at this point could have been the number one pick in next year's draft if they have the worst record in baseball again, and it could be the number two pick in next year's draft as compensation for not signing Brady Aiken. So, of course, they're not going to take that. They're not going to do that. So they, even though Nix agreed to terms in good faith and passed his physical, they basically said, look, sorry, we can't sign you. So that's what happened there. And for now, there's a grievance that's been filed, not by the players because they're not members of the union, but by the union against the Astros, the details of which I don't think have really been reported or come out. But my guess is that the union's complaining that, you know, Aiken, other doctors looked at this MRI that Aiken had on his elbow and were fine with it, and that Nix agreed in good faith and passed a physical and should be signed. Now, I'm not going to be the one hearing the case, but assuming that's the logic, which would seem to be the most direct path to a grievance, I don't know if they can really win for two reasons. One, just the cases themselves, if my assumptions are correct, I don't know that you could tell a team they're not entitled to whatever medical opinion they wish to hold. I mean, that's very subjective, and different doctors look at things differently. And then Nix's case, I mean, absent having a written signed agreement, I don't know if he has a contract that can really be enforced. And while it stinks what happened to him, and Casey Close, you know, when he was talking before deadline, said, you know, look, this is wrong. You know, the signing should not be interrelated. I agree philosophically with him, but we all know how these – I mean, you guys know, I know. We know how the bonus pools work. The signings are interrelated. And even if you don't say, hey, well, you know, we're agreeing to this on the assumption that we sign these other guys and it fits on our pool, that's kind of the way it is. So I don't know if they can win it on the merits. And then just looking at precedent – and this, I know, this is probably the longest answer anybody's ever given to one of your questions. But on precedent, way back when J.D. Drew was the fifth overall pick in 97, he didn't sign with the Phillies. Instead, he went and played in the independent Northern League, which might have been the first year of the Northern League or second year. And so the next year, when MLB said, okay, J.D. Drew's going to be subject to a draft, Scott Boras pointed out, well, look, this is called the amateur draft. J.D. Drew signed a professional contract. He's clearly not an amateur. He has no amateur eligibility. He shouldn't be subject to this. So the Cardinals drafted him, and the MLBPA filed a grievance on Drew's behalf, saying he should not be subject to the draft. And the arbitrator basically ruled, yes, you're right. And not coincidentally, MLB almost immediately changed the name of the draft to the first year player draft. But the arbitrator also ruled that J.D. Drew, like all draftees, is not a member of the union. And as such, the arbitrator had no jurisdiction over him. So even though Drew shouldn't really have been subject to this draft, the arbitrator had no power because he wasn't in his jurisdiction to make him a free agent. So anyway, this is coming right to the end of my answer. Even if they somehow won their grievance, which is always possible, even though if I'm assuming correctly, I find it hard to believe that they might win. But assuming that even if they won the grievance, it's possible arbitrator could say, yeah, you're right, you guys have a case and you deserve to win, but you guys aren't members of the union, so I can't do anything about it. So that's a very long answer. That's what happened. And I mean, this isn't over yet, but I don't really see where this is going to go from here, or at least what's going to be a positive resolution that's going to result in these guys signing for the money that they originally agreed to.
So if they don't get the money that they originally agreed to, where do you think these guys will go? Are they going to go back to junior college, or are they going to end up in UCLA? Where do you think they'll end up?
Who knows? Because it's all – as a reporter and as a fan, I'd like to know what's going on, but nobody's really talking much. I mean, they have a number of options. I mean, they could go to UCLA. They're both committed to UCLA. There's some question with Casey Close speaking out publicly. Could that jeopardize their eligibility? Although nothing was said about negotiations. He just said, you know, acting as family advisor. So I'm not sure that Casey has said anything publicly that would in and of itself jeopardize their eligibility. Who knows? I mean, there's also some question as to how the NCAA would treat somebody who intended on signing a contract but didn't follow through on it. So they may or may not be able to even go to UCLA or be eligible if they go there. They could be, if they go to UCLA, they aren't eligible for the draft until 2017. If they go to a junior college or they went and played an independent league, they would be eligible for the 2015 draft. So they could do that. It's possible if this grievance doesn't work out, it's possible they could file a lawsuit. I'm not sure how that would work, but I mean, as these guys aren't members of the union, I don't think the grievance and the decision made by the person who hears the grievance is the be-all and end-all, because they aren't members of the union. So theoretically, if the grievance process doesn't yield a positive result, they could file a lawsuit. But it's very unclear what these guys are going to do. I mean, you have a lot of people speculating about what could happen. I don't think there's any way that Brady Aiken gets made a free agent. I mean, people have speculated, you know, the MLB's not going to agree to that. They're not going to happen. And like I said before, I mean, it stinks what happened to Brady Aiken. There's a disputed medical exam. The exact same thing happened last year with a lot less publicity to Marlins and their supplemental first-round pick, Matt Crook. And he wound up going to Oregon, and he wound up blowing out his elbow and having Tommy John surgery. But I don't see, you know, I consider myself impartial in this stuff. I don't see how you can look at this and say, well, the Astros doctor had a medical opinion and they're not entitled to it. Of course they are. The process is broken. You shouldn't be doing physicals after the draft. You should be doing before the draft if possible. There should be remedy, and there should be better remedy. Because, you know, I mentioned that 40% rule earlier. The 40% rule is a terrible rule, and the union, even though the union's, you know, screaming about what happened with Aiken and Nicks, the union agreed to this 40% rule, so it's their fault too. You know, if a player fails a physical, and the physical is at the sole discretion of the team physician, then all the team has to do to get a compensation pick, like in Aiken's case, the number two pick next year, is offering 40% of the bonus. Well, that 40% threshold is so low that it's a no-brainer for the team to offer it, and it's a no-brainer for the player to reject it. It's just a ridiculously low number. So, you know, we'll see. I don't think there's any way Aiken can really become a free agent. Nicks, I could see possibly you have a situation where Nicks, you know, here's the tricky thing. If you said, okay, look, Nicks had an agreement in good faith, and he passed a physical, so he should get $1.5 million. Here's the problem you run into. If you make the Astros sign him, and you say, look, you guys have to honor this contract. Well, if you count it against their bonus pool, which theoretically you should, then they lose the number one and two picks in next year's draft, which would be ridiculous. They would never do that willfully. And if you say, look, in this one time only, we won't let this count against the bonus pool, if I'm another team, I'm like, well, wait a minute, you can't do that. You can't give them a free $1.5 million to spend. That's not right. And then the third option would be to do something like happened way back when Tom Seaver was drafted, and it turned out he was ineligible for the January draft he was drafted in, but he had signed, so he compromised his eligibility. And the commissioner's office basically said, anybody who wants to match the bonus that Tom Seaver agreed to, we'll put your name in the hat, we'll draw one out, and you can have Tom Seaver. You could do something like that for Jacob Nicks, but Nicks is a good prospect. We had him rated as kind of like a third-round pick. He didn't have a great spring. I don't know if anybody else in baseball valued Jacob Nicks at $1.5 million. So you could set that would be the fairest resolution at all for Jacob Nicks, except I'm not sure you have anybody who would necessarily say, yeah, we'll give you $1.5 million for Jacob Nicks. I mean, you probably would if it didn't count against the pool. It's like a free signing, and teams can't spend as much on the amateur draft or the first-year player draft as they like to. But, you know, it's possible you could set up that special lottery for Jacob Nicks and not have anybody say, we want to pay him $1.5 million.
So you mentioned with I want to say Steven, J.D. Drew, how they changed the name of the draft from the amateur draft to the first year player draft. Do you see anything coming from this? Maybe a little bit deeper, not quite as cosmetic, that could change in the draft based on what happened with this situation.
I do think they definitely will address. Well, I don't know if it'll happen in this CBA, which has two more drafts to run, or if it'll happen in the next CBA. Because the CBA, getting anything changed in the CBA, a lot of times, even if it makes sense for both sides, it's like nobody wants to be the one pushing for it, because then the other side is going to be like, okay, what are we getting in return? That's just the nature of the CBA negotiation. I mean, they're going to have to address the physicals and the way they go about it. I mean, the current CBA actually has language that says they're going to have a pre-draft medical combine for the top 200 players in the draft. And right now, the Major League Scouting Bureau determines who the top 200 players are in the draft, which doesn't necessarily agree with what our list would be or Baseball America's, but I mean, it's a fairly good list. And all those guys have mandatory drug testing. You don't take the drug test, you aren't eligible for the draft. You know, and that's reason. I mean, you could send collectors all over the country to get the samples from the guys. The problem with the medical combine, the reason it has come off, is it's almost logistically impossible. You have high school seasons that are going on through the draft or right up into the draft. You have college seasons that are going on, but, you know, through the draft. You know, the College World Series is a couple weeks after the draft or right up before the draft. You know, you'd have some, you know, so I don't even know how you logistically would do it. I've had guys suggest, you know, maybe you have kind of regional medical combines, but I mean, I don't know how many of those you could do. And you still wouldn't get everybody, because I mean, I'll be honest, if I'm a college coach, I don't want my high profile draftee to find out that teams have a question about his elbow when he's going to go pitch a regional championship game. You know, I want my guy focusing on, you know, most players do, you know, trying to focus on my season and not the draft. You know, but I think the simplest solution for that would be push a draft back to the end of June. It's kind of silly you're drafting players, you know, when the college season has 2 or 3 weeks to go on. If you push it to the end of June, you do a medical combine. I don't think you can really compel players players to attend the medical combine? Like, I don't think you can really compel players to attend the drug testing. Somebody could probably sue and win that. But nobody really fights that. But you could – so you, if you had a medical combine, not everybody would attend. You'd have some agents who wouldn't want their guys to or whatever. But at least you'd give that option. And then it's like if you don't attend and you fall prey to a failed physical, so be it. I mean, Scott Boras actually had a – you know, who doesn't represent either one of these guys, had an interesting idea that, that Ken Rosenthal wrote about and I wrote about, where if you had a situation like this, if a player failed a physical, instead of the 40% rule, which is terrible, the player could declare free agency – within 5 days of failing the physical. But he would be limited to signing either for the amount or his pick value, whichever's higher. So it's not – I mean, if Brady Aiken was a free agent, Brady Aiken would probably get a $30 million deal if a team thought he was healthy. If you didn't have any physical concerns, on an open market, these guys get so much more money. So you're not going to – you know, you wouldn't make Brady Aiken a free agent to where he could sign for anything. But Brady Aiken would be able to sign for either $6.5 million, which he agreed to, or his pick value, which in this case is like $7.9 million. So he could sign a – you know, he could sign with a free agent for somebody for $7.9 million. So it would be good for Brady Aiken. The team would still get the compensation pick that it would get now. So the Astros would still get the number two pick. But Scott's other suggestion, and I kind of like this, because again, you're operating on the principle everybody here was doing all this with good faith. If the team agreed to sign the player for less than pick value, so in Aiken's case, it's for like $1.4 million under his pick value, and he elects to become a free agent, instead of losing all of his money from their bonus pool, they would only lose the amount they agreed to. So they would still retain $1.4 million. That was attributed to that number one overall pick, in which case they could have signed Jacob Nix. And so if you had that situation, I actually think everybody, you know, it's a good suggestion by Scott. Everybody would be happy. Aiken would sign for $7.9 million with somebody, you know, assuming there were teams who thought his elbow was fine. The Astros would still get the number two pick as compensation for not signing him, and they'd still be able to sign Jacob Nix, and Jacob Nix would be happy. But, you know, again, I'm giving long answers because it's kind of a complicated situation. They're going to have to address something with the medical combine, because – or not the medical combine, but the procedure for – you know, maybe you have – you know, medical physicals are, you know, there are some cases where the agents don't just say team doctor. They say, look, this is, we're going to do it with this doctor. They agree. They make an agreement with the team which doctor they're going to use, and if he fails, this is step B. But they need to have it more than just this simple process. You take the physical. After we pick you, after you agree to money, we take the physical. And then if we don't see something we don't like in the physical, which is solely at our discretion, then we only have to offer you 40% of the bonus value. It's just – it's a bad system, and obviously Aiken has put this at the forefront, but the exact same thing happened last year with Matt Crook, who was the Marlins supplemental first-round pick. And if you guys recall, Philip Bickford, who you know, we talked, I think, about in the past about how the Royals were interested in drafting him but couldn't get a real read on him. You know, he didn't sign with the Blue Jays as a 10th overall pick. I've never confirmed it well enough to write it, but I've had people suggest – I think there was some kind of failed physical issue with Philip Bickford too. It isn't like this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing with Brady Aiken. In all likelihood, there's going to be a high-profile guy next year, probably not the number one overall pick, but a high-profile guy next year who doesn't pass the team physical, and you wind up going through this all over again.
Furthermore, you said that other teams would be interested in Aiken if he was a free agent. But do the Astros have a problem with the perception of how they are handling things? First, you have the Aiken thing, you got the leak of the possible trades, you got how they handled George Springer with negotiating contract, and wouldn't call him up, and now this Mark Appel thing. What's the feeling about them throughout baseball?
No, they do have a perception problem. I mean, on the Mark Appel thing, Mark Appel was getting lit up at Lancaster, which is the worst place to pitch in the minors. Now, granted, other guys have success there. I'm not making an excuse for him. They need to get Mark Appel out of Lancaster, so promote him to Double-A. I think everybody, including Mark Appel, is not looking at it and saying, oh, he had a 10 ERA. He earned that promotion with his performance. Everybody knows why they're getting him out of there. There's no question about that. And so he's going from Lancaster, California, to Corpus Christi, Texas, and the Astros decide, hey, we're going to have him throw a bullpen in Minute Maid Park for Brent Strom, our pitching coach, see what he thinks. I don't know about you guys. Do you see anything wrong with that? It wasn't they put Mark Appel's name on the scoreboard or put him on the big league roster. They want their big league coach to look at him, so they brought him to the park. And the fact that the Astros, you know, have veterans who are incensed by this, I think that's the – in this case, when you talk about these other controversies, those guys need to grow up. I mean, the guy's throwing a bullpen, okay? Nobody's giving him anything, and he's heading to Corpus Christi. So just shut up. You know, Mark Appel's got enough going on. He's throwing a bullpen for your pitching coach. So anyway, we'll get back to the perception thing. But, I mean, did you guys have a problem with him throwing a bullpen for Brent Strom? I mean, well, I don't see what the big deal is about that.
Not at all, no.
I don't see any problem with it, but I wonder if there's some – if there's the handling of the players within the organization just in general, and that's what created this, you know, it's
maybe, I separate them, I guess. I mean, possibly, but I mean, there is a perception problem. And also the perception problem, they could finish with the worst record in baseball for the fourth straight year, that they have TV games that literally draw ratings of 0.0. Nobody, there's no measurable audience. And yeah, there is a perception problem. I mean, this comes on the heels of them being on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Astros, your 2017 World Series champions. They just aced the number one pick in the draft by taking Brady Aiken. They didn't write the article. I'm sure somewhere Joe Morgan's thinking that Jeff Luno should not have written that article. But, you know, it's not like the Astros wrote the article, but they're taking heat for that. But no, there is a perception problem. I think there's a perception in baseball that, you know, the Astros – whether it's fair or not that the Astros think they're the smallest kid in the room and they're doing things differently and they're hiring people who don't have a lot of baseball experience. And I mean, with the Aiken thing, I do give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't believe this was some plan they hatched, like, hey, let's play a game with the physical and then we can get Mac Marshall and Jacob Nix. I don't even think it was, oh, we don't like this physical. Hey, you know what we could do? We could take advantage of this. I think they believed there were legitimate concerns about his elbow. And I do believe that they did what anybody else would have done is if you think like, hey, we might not spend $6.5 million on Aiken. It might be closer to five. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Say, well, we'll just let $1.5 million of our spending power disappear, or you start looking at what you could do with that. So I don't really fault them for that, but I don't think they handled the whole Aiken thing really well after he failed the physical. I mean, if it's – again, it's easy for me to say because I'm not the GM. But if it's me, there's a number of things I would have done differently. One, okay, you have to make the 40% offer of right around $3.2 million to protect the pick. But when you make that offer, I would have said, look, we're all kind of, you know, you guys are shocked at our finding. We're trying to figure out what this means. You guys want to figure out what this means. We're making this 40% offer. It's not a final offer. We're simply doing it to protect ourselves. I want you guys gather medical opinions, see what you think. We're going to gather medical opinions. Let's reconvene in a week. It sounds like about two – if you fail the physical on June 23rd, almost 3 weeks elapsed, I think, before the sides really – before the Astros really reached back out seriously, as far as I can tell, to the Aikens and their advisor, Casey Close. So I think that was a mistake. I also – I would have gotten back to it and said, look, we're going to reconvene in a week. In a week, if I determine – I mean – yeah, you've already agreed to 6.5. So this negotiation's already blown up. So I'm not sitting here trying to get leverage or power or who's got hand or whatever. If I'm the Astros and I've decided in my mind that I think he's worth $5 million, I'm offering him $5 million a week after he fails. When we meet again, it's a good faith gesture. Hey, look, we're not trying to squeeze you. Hey, right now we're willing to go to five. What do you guys think? Obviously, they wouldn't have taken it at that time, but at least it's out there rather than you're making that offer sometime late on the afternoon of the deadline. And, you know, they did reach out. I believe they did reach out to the family earlier than the deadline. But, you know, talking about perception problems, Jeff Luno, the GM of the Astros, had a family vacation scheduled, I believe, in Mexico that week. Figuring everybody's done. You know, I mean, obviously, this guy's high stress. It's a 24/7, 365 job. Hey, sign deadline's all taken care of. We got our guys agreed to. So he planned the vacation with the family. And I won't purport to work as many hours as Jeff. I do work a lot. And I just think if that was my family, as much as it would stink, I've got four kids, I would tell my wife, look, I'm really sorry. But either you guys are going to have to go without me. You know, we'll send an in-law down there. We'll send some grandparents. But, like, we can't screw this up. I've got to be here. I wouldn't be trying to negotiate from Mexico. I'd be flying to California or I'd be flying to New York if Casey Close's office is in New York. You know, these are just little things that I think could have been handled better. And my sense is, again, I don't think the Astros did anything nefarious here. I do think they kind of looked at this, you know, I mean, they looked at this as you know, like a number problem. Like, okay, his talent is worth I guess $6.5 million if we think he's healthy. With the risk based on his elbow, we think it is he's worth, and apparently that number was right around $5 million. So he's worth $5 million, and we're not going a dollar over $5 million, or slightly more. We're not going much over $5 million. And when it all came down to it at the end, I mean, they could have signed Aiken for $5.85 million and gotten Nick Stunn and gotten Mac Marshall signed too, the 21st rounder. So I would have come at him with $5.85 million. And again, I wouldn't have waited till the last day. And if that didn't work, because the thing is, even if you think he's worth five, well, there's also the added value of signing him brings in Jacob Nix and Mac Marshall. So he's worth, if his talent's worth five, you can put one more on top. So I would have offered him every penny I could offer him and still sign the other two guys. And if they still said no, at that point, I would have thought long and hard. And again, this is tricky because I don't know what the medical said. I'm not a doctor. I don't have a number of medical opinions telling me what to think of this elbow. I still would have seriously considered, you know what? We can't not sign this guy. If we think he's worth five, or we think he's worth 5.85, plus we get Jacob Nix, let's sign for 6.5 and get Jacob Nix done. Because when I first heard word that this might happen, we didn't know all the details, and this was a couple weeks before the deadline, and the rumor was that they were going to try to sign for around $5 million. And I had no idea what was going on, what was going on with physical. I told a number of people, if you think he's worth five, if you still think he's worth enough to pay five, why wouldn't you just pay him the 6.5 rather than create this perception he's damaged goods and whatever else it can cause? So, again, it's easier for me to say sitting in my seat, but I don't think they was they're nefarious, but I do think they mishandled the situation. And I agree with I'm giving you probably the longest average answers ever on one of your podcasts. But getting back to the original question that spurred this, yes, there's a huge perception problem with the Astros for a variety of reasons. And it's not going to make Jeff Luno's job any easier.
Well, at this point, how do they fix that?
I don't know. I mean, It's tough. I mean, not that it was Jeff's fault, but when he was with the Cardinals, I mean, there were some people who didn't like him because he didn't have a baseball background. He came from a business background, and there was kind of a power struggle there that I don't really think was of his making. That led to Walt Jocketty getting let go in St. Louis about a year after they won the World Series, and Walt's very popular. And so I think there's just a lot of people who resent Jeff for being different to begin with. And you look at these things. I'm not pro Astro, anti Astro. I have no, I have no animus against them. I don't root for any team. I hope everybody does well. And, we have great baseball. I'm very magnanimous, I guess. But so I don't have any axe to grind against Jeff. But I mean, I felt a little bad. I mean, when this thing blew up, I had a couple texts from people kind of saying, kind of like, haha, Astros screwed this one up too. I think I got two texts from people saying, look, they bungled this one. Pretty funny. And it's like, I was thinking, I kind of feel bad. I might be the only person because it seems like a lot of people blame me out, but I kind of feel bad for everybody involved. I mean, I feel bad for Aiken and Nix and not signing the deals they thought they had done. And I feel bad for the Astros for not getting these guys too, because like I said, I really don't think this was some nefarious or contrived plan. Could they have handled it better? Yes. But I think they honestly are concerned about his elbow, or they would have signed him for $6.5 million. They wouldn't have messed around with this pick. When they took Mac Marshall, it was more of a flyer. I think if they didn't work out terms with Nix for $1.5 million, then they would have paid Mac Marshall about the same money. I don't think they ever looked at it like we're going to sign on all three of these guys.
Well, obviously, you said you don't hate every team, but looking at your top 100 list, it's pretty clear you hate the Royals. You ran in Kyle Zimmer worse than Mark Appel and his 10 ERA. What's your problem?
I know, we were joking about that. I think the last time I was on the podcast, we talked about my story that cursed Kyle Zimmer, where I wrote about how the Royals were going out of their way to be cautious and come up with a plan that would have Kyle Zimmer healthy and peaking in August and September for the pennant drive. And we're almost in August, and he still hasn't thrown a pitch yet in an official game. You guys probably know better than me. Is he pitching an extended spring? I haven't.
He was supposed to start throwing, I want to say last week, maybe. Yeah, I think it was last week. I actually haven't seen if he did or not.
Yeah, I haven't. Just with the sign deadline and our stuff, we just relaunched all of our top 20 lists. I'm not monitored, but yeah, basically we had Appel ahead of Zimmer to begin with, and I guess you could argue. I mean, one guy's having a horrible year, although his pure stuff's pretty good. It's been his command, and Lancaster hasn't helped. But I mean, you can't blame the whole 10 ERA in the ballpark in the Cal League versus a guy who we had ranked lower than Mark Appel, who hasn't been able to get to a mound yet this year. So I guess suffice it to say that I would have thought that we would have had both those guys ranked a lot higher at this point. And maybe even they wouldn't qualify for, well, maybe not a Pell, but that maybe Zimmer would not even qualify for our list by the end of the year. I don't know what to tell you on those two guys. I mean, Appel should be doing better than he has. It's an understatement, and I really like Kyle Zimmer. The stuff's great, but, I mean, the guy just hasn't been able to stay healthy as a pro.
Yeah, but you can look at the flip side and say he hasn't given up a run this year.
That's right. Well, he's got a fresh arm. He's got a fresh arm. But,
fresh, yeah.
Yeah, he continues to have a fresh arm. That's been
yeah. I mean, that's just the sad thing. I mean, and like, at least the good thing is it's not like there's anything going on, like he's, you know, got a torn labrum or something, and hopefully I didn't just jinx him. But you know, it's more like he had discomfort, stemming back to discomfort really from the end of last season. So it's not anything horrible. And, you know, and if you get him healthy, I mean, you're talking plus-plus fastball, you know, curveball's plus-plus at times, slider's plus, changeup can be plus, control's plus. He's athletic. He's kind of the ideal size for a pitcher. I mean, everything – you can check off every box on this guy except for health right now. And it's been kind of frustrating because it's been more nagging things rather than something serious where he needs a major surgery and he's going to miss a year. But so he's – you know, it's not like he's shut down to where he can't pitch, but he hasn't been able to get healthy enough to stay on the mound. So I still am very high on him, but, I mean, he's one of those guys that you kind of could rank wherever. I mean, we could rank him back up in the 20s where we had him originally based on upside, or you could ding him further and say, look, this, you know, this guy's been hurt all three of his years as a pro. We got to move him down. So I wish I knew what the answer was on him. I mean, he's a very interesting guy. I like him a lot, but we'll have to see.
Well, another guy you ranked pretty highly in the Royals list, yeah, I think you had the Royals' first-round pick this year, Brandon Finnegan. You had him ranked sixth in the organization. What do you see his path as this season?
I think they're going to kind of take it easy on him, I would think, because you know he had some – I don't think it was anything major, but he had like a shoulder deal at TCU where his shoulder bothered him a little bit, so he missed a start, and then he wasn't as effective – like his first couple starts back, came back and he pitched. I saw him in the College World Series and he looked really good. And I know from talking to scouts, the idea was that the idea on Finnegan, I think, was that it was more kind of normal soreness and not anything really to be worried by. But I still think that, you know, college pitcher went to College World Series, they may get him an inning or two here or there, but it's not, I don't think they're really going to cut him loose until next year, to be honest with you.
How do you guys – now, when you guys rank your list 1 through 20, how well do you know the international prospects? That's a big question of mine. You know the big-name signee guys, but the Royals have a couple guys that kind of flashed up this year that in Julio Pinto, he's been getting a little bit written about him, guy that I've been watching a lot at Idaho Falls, Wander Franco. How well do you guys know the international guys?
Well, I will give you the caveat that I did not do the Royals list personally, so I'm not as up on those guys. I can't remember if Jonathan Mayo or Teddy Cahill did the Royals, but I know in the organizations I do try to keep up on guys. Now, granted, I will generally wait. We just had the July 2 signing season. We were working on these lists. I didn't put anybody from any of these recent July 2 signings on top 20s yet. I will be more apt to put those guys on the list in the off season when we revise the lists again. But for the organizations I do, like, for instance, the Red Sox, Rafael Devers was a big ticket signing last year, and he's tearing it up in rookie ball right now. I do stay aware of those guys. I will admit, I wish I was more on top of the international guys all over baseball, but there's just simply so many of them. I mean, my head would explode. I mean, the draft almost makes my head explode. But I do like to feel that on the 10 organizations, we divide up the organizations. So I have 10 farm systems. The 10 systems I do like to feel like I am up on the international guys who are in the U.S. and the, you know, say, seven-figure, $800,000 guys, you know, who maybe aren't over here yet but will be soon. So I don't know if I answered the question well, but for the Royals, I didn't do the list, so I can't tell you how close those guys were to making it and how much they were how much we knew about them.
On the subject of the process, how do you balance and weigh potential versus production?
You have to balance the two. I don't think there's a formula. I mean, I think the higher up a guy gets in the system, the more, you can have all the tools in the world, but you got to show some production. Not to pick on poor Bubba Starling, but Bubba Starling, in terms of pure tools, has great tools, but he's played well enough to where it's really kind of hard to have faith that he's going to hit a whole lot. So at this point, the production is outweighing the potential because it just hasn't been there. But, I think kind of double A is kind of where the balance tilts. Like when the guys are younger, you're more apt to look at the tools and the upside and say, okay, he's young. He's got to figure, just picking a guy, for example, Scott Blewett, signed for $1.8 million. My guess is Scott didn't throw a lot of changeups in New York high school ball. So, you can sit there, he's learning control. He's got to work on a changeup. I mean, he's pitching fine. But, if he were getting shelled, you'd kind of say, I can see that. Hitter, takes time to make adjustments, better pitching than they're used to facing, that type of thing. But I think when you get to double A and, high class A, maybe it's your second or third year in pro ball, you got to start seeing results. You look at the tools, you look at the stats, you got to factor them both in. I'm trying to come up with a definitive answer. I guess the younger the guy is, I probably lean more towards tools, what the guy can be, and give him some time. Like, for instance, Mondesi's really struggling this year for the Royals, but he's 19 years old. He's in high class A, so I'm going to cut him some slack. And he's 19. I think he turned 19, yesterday? So he barely is 19. So it's like, I'm not going to worry about that. But, I'm trying to think of an example. Most of the Royals guys are – pretty young. The example, Christian Colon was a first round pick, in 2010. As I've told you guys in the past, I always liked Christian Colon. I thought he'd be better, a little bit. I wouldn't have taken him fourth. I thought he'd be better than this. And he's having a better year this year. But Christian Colon's 25. He hasn't really torn it up. He's been in double A, triple A for a while. So, at that point, you're kind of looking at the production, I think, gives you a clearer picture than tools when the guy's that old and you have more track record. I kind of soured on Montgomery before they traded him to the Rays. I'm still convinced he got hurt when he had the elbow issue back in, after the dominant April, which was probably 3 or 4 years ago. But the guy didn't produce and got hit in double A and got hit in triple A and got sent back to double A. At some point you stop saying, I've seen this out of him in the past. He's got these pitches, and just say, look, the guy's not getting the production done. So you got to take both into account. And I do think the stats versus scouts argument that Moneyball kind of popularized has kind of died down because I think even back then, the teams that people would have thought, those are heavy scout teams, almost all those teams looked at statistics. It's not like anybody's like, I'm just going to look at tools and performance doesn't matter. Nobody drafted that way. College stats are all over the internet. So, people are looking at them. It's just, I think you got to avoid falling to the other trap too, though, is putting too much reliance on stats at lower levels that don't mean as much. Especially if you're trying to attach a lot of significance to college or high school stats or even rookie ball or short season stats, I think you're fooling yourself. I think they can be, at those levels, I think it's more red flags. If there's a guy you like and he's not performing, you're like, this guy's throwing 95. Why is he not striking guys out? But just because a guy's hitting 380 in the SEC doesn't mean the guy's going to be a big leaguer.
You talk about Mike Montgomery, and he's had a nice bounce back year with Tampa Bay. Jake Odorizzi's having a great year. He's really piling it on. It's been real strong in the second half. And Patrick Leonard is doing very well. Have you talked to people in the industry? Do the Royals just have a problem with development? Is that the big problem here with this team?
I wouldn't say that. I think the Royals have some smart guys there, and they had success developing players with the Braves. The biggest problem for the Royals, and I don't know if it's anything they're doing wrong or it's just the nature of the beast, they've had very little luck with pitchers. Or not even luck, I should say success with pitchers. It's like a lot of pitchers that they've counted on have got hurt. I don't think those guys weren't developing in the Royals. Will Myers was the minor league of the year when I was at Baseball America. Jake Odorizzi, he's on a roll right now, but Jake Odorizzi was progressing fine when he was with the Royals. I think he was just as highly regarded coming into this year as he was the year before when he was with the Royals. Montgomery's having an okay year. He's got a 3.75 ERA. He's, you know, striking out 7 per 9 innings, more hits than strikeouts. I still think, you know, I don't think there's a true plus pitch there. So, I mean, he's, yeah, I mean, he's not having a 5.5 ERA or whatever he had in AAA with the Royals. But I, like I said with him before, I'm still convinced he got hurt. I like, and that's just me playing doctor from, you know, my home here in suburban Chicago. But I'll just continue to believe that something happened to him physically. Like, what was it? It was like 2010, I want to say, right? I want to say it was April 2010. And he looked like he was the best left-handed pitching prospect in baseball, and he had like a strained elbow, and his control has never been the same since, and his stuff hasn't been as good. So he obviously hasn't had, you know, Tommy John surgery or anything like that, but I'm convinced that whatever he did, he's not, you know, it traces back to him getting hurt that April. And I might be totally wrong, but I will continue to hold an opinion. But I'm not convinced that Mike Montgomery is going to be anything special. And Patrick Leonard is having a nice year. I'm still, again, I mean, the Royals had him very young. And that I don't think was a development issue. I'm not the biggest Patrick Leonard fan in the world, because when I was a Baseball American, he was coming out of Texas. Texas was one of my draft states, and I talked to 3 or 4 area scouts about him, and none of them was a Patrick Leonard fan, and they were all shocked he won the 5th round. So, yeah, I mean, he's had a nice year in Charlotte. You know, had a terrible year last year in the Midwest League. When he was in the Rays system too, and he had a really good year when he was in the Appy League for the Royals. So I don't think you can really point to Montgomery or him as Rays success stories, you know, finding something the Royals didn't. I mean, because if you asked me a year ago, Montgomery was really mediocre, and Leonard was, you know, had like a 648 ops in the Midwest League, and you could have said, boy, the Rays are really screwing those guys up. So.
All right, one more question, then once you get out of here, just a pretty simple one. Who is the one prospect in the Royals organization that you would be the most loath to give up in a trade?
So that's an interesting question, because, you know, like Mondesi, we have rated as our top prospect, but he's also 19, and he's really struggling this year. You know, we talked about Zimmer. You know, Manaea, you know, I really like Sean Manaea, but he had health issues in the past, although he's over. I mean, I guess it's tough. I mean, I would probably say, well, you know, I'll cheat. I'm going to say Sean Manaea, because I'm going to use my rationale that they already have Escobar at shortstop, so they could give up Mondesi and still be fine at shortstop, and Zimmer's hurt. So I'm going to say Sean Manaea, although I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can almost see a case where you could trade any of these guys in the right deal. I mean, I never believe anybody's untouchable. But, like, you know, if Sean Manaea, it's not like he's dominating high class A. But I'd say it's probably him. It would probably be Manaea would be the guy I'd be the most reluctant to give up.
All right, we'll pass that along. So
how about you? Which guy would you guys be most reluctant to give up?
Don't turn that around on me. I don't know.
I am. I'm curious. It's a great question, because there's no – it's not like well, the Twins would be interesting because they have depth, but it's not like you're in an organization where, like, you asked about the Astros. Okay, it's clearly Carlos Correa. You know, I think you could really go with a bunch of different answers here. So I want to know who you guys would be. Who would you guys be the most distressed to see parted with in a trade?
I would go with Zimmer, just because his value is so deflated right now.
See, that's a good answer, because you're right. If they traded him, they would be selling low on him, and that would not be good either.
I would probably. Personally, I'd say Mondesi, just because I think he's the only guy in the system on the position player side right now who has that superstar potential. I'm not sure he'll get there, but I think he's got the best chance to get there of anybody. And not a huge chance, but he's still got that chance.
No, you're fair. I mean, I like Hunter Dozier, but I don't think Hunter Dozier is going to be a superstar. I think he can be a good big league regular. So, see, I mean, that's why it's a great question. All three of us, we had three different answers there. So, and likewise, if they traded Mondesi, to some extent, they'd be selling low on him too, because he's struggling in high class A. So, but the good news is, I don't think they're trading any of those three guys. So, I don't think any of us will be distressed here before the trade deadline.
We'll never find out if we were right. No.
Watch out, though. The Royals will go ahead and trade Mondesi, Zimmer, and Manaea to go get, like, John Lester or something.
Hey, you heard it here first.
I wouldn't be totally in favor of that move, but for what those players are doing right now, it might not be the worst move, and the Royals might – win the World Series if they added Lester to the rotation.
Well, the crazy thing is the ultimate success of that move would really be judged on whether or not they got to the postseason.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, those guys could all become, you know, big all-stars, but if the Royals made it to the postseason or you know, let's say they rode John Lester to a World Series championship, everybody'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I think they would, especially after this hiatus that they've had, but... Well, thanks, Jim.
They're only going to go to the postseason if they can win it all. You know, it's like, what's the point? If you're going to not win the World Series, there's no point in going back, right? So,
like the Marlins, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what the plan is. It's a 30-year plan. We go in 85, we'll go in 2015, we'll win again. It'll be our turn. There's 30 teams in baseball. We'll win it for 30 years, and then we'll come back and see us in 2045.
That'll probably give me 3 championships in my lifetime, so I'm good with that.
Yeah, I probably only get 2. I don't think I'll make it to 2045.
That's not that far away.
All right, Jim. Thanks again. You know, email me your address, Jim. I'll send you some of that. I think it's called the Ale Storm. It's the Storm Chasers.
Yeah, and I went to Omaha. I made it to Omaha. I was actually covering this year, and I once again did not go to a Omaha Storm Chasers game. So, and I should have. I was running around because I actually covered it this year. I should have said something when I was up there. But it's like, were they home? They're home for part of the series now, right?
Yeah, they were home for, I think, the last week.
Yeah, so they were home when I was there, but because I was actually covering it for MLB.com. They had 2 games on Saturday, and then on Sunday they had a press conference, and I had to write a preview. So it's just like, I mean, I'd be tempted to go, but like I told you, we ran each other in surprise. Like, I love the College World Series, but like after going to, and I was out there earlier this year too, so I think I'd seen something like 1, 2, 3. I'd seen like 8 or 10 games in 5, 6 days, and there was one that was delayed with weather. And there was a 15-inning game. It was like I wasn't looking to run out to another game on Sunday. So I didn't make it. But, yeah, I'll do that. And let me know when the podcast goes up, and I'll be happy to tweet it out.
Will do.
Definitely.
Okay, well, take care, guys. It was fun talking to you. It's more of an Astros podcast, I think, than a Royals podcast.
Yeah, it turned out that way, didn't it?
That's all right.
Good discussion. So, but, yeah, just let me know what's up, and I'll be happy to do it.
All right. Talk to you later, Jim.
Okay, take care, guys. Bye-bye.
If you're listening to the Pine Tar Podcast, you're probably familiar with baseballreference.com. I know I go there almost every day. And for any other baseball fan, it's a daily visit. It shows up to date stats and team stats and league leaders and game previews and all sorts of things that I look at just for all sorts of information that I put out on Twitter. It's pretty awesome. But if you want to dig even deeper and you want to go beyond what Baseball Reference just puts out there, you can subscribe to the Baseball Reference Play Index. You know, if you want to know what player's done this and what player's done that and check to see who has the most 4-hit games in a season, who has the most 10 strikeout games in a season for a pitcher, just go to the Baseball Reference Play Index. If you haven't already subscribed, we have an offer for you. If you put in Royals into the form, you can get a $6 discount for Baseball Reference Play Index, which makes it just $30 for the entire season. All that, and you can be looking up stats that'll make your friends say, huh? Trust me, you won't regret it. That was Jim Callis of MLB.com. Great interview, as always. Just a beacon of prospect and draft and other knowledge. We're happy to have him on. I know we went a little bit long on the Astro stuff, and this is the Pine Tar podcast and not the Talus Hill podcast or whatever, but I thought that was just fascinating. This whole scenario, to me, is something that I've been paying close attention to just because the domino effect that it caused, like I mentioned when I asked him the question, it's very interesting to me.
Oh, it's totally interesting to me too, and I've been a fan of the new system in that because if you look at the international pool this year, there's really no regulations. There's small regulations in that you lose players the next year. And my thought process with the new draft rules was this would prevent the Yankees and the Rangers and the big market teams from going in and just buying all the players, which I think eventually it would have turned to that, where these players would have just said, you know, I don't care my slot. I don't care if you guys take me, but my price is $6 million. And so if you can't pay me that, I'm going to college or I'm going wherever. and they would have just fallen to the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Rangers over time. I think just eventually what would have happened is they would have all pushed their numbers so high that teams wouldn't have been able to afford them. And we used to see that a little bit in the first 5 or 10 picks. I think the Royals, a good reason they didn't take Buster Posey or Matt Wieters was because their asking price was higher than for the Royals than it was for other teams. And so I think MLB got in front of it, got ahead of the game a little bit, but in the process, in terms of anything, when you change the rules to anything, there's going to be loopholes. And unfortunately, the Astros took advantage of a loophole, and even one I don't think they wanted to take, but in the end, it got messed up. So,
yeah. I think another name, Rick Porcello, comes to mind as a guy who, I mean, he was talked about with that Royals pick that they took Mike Moustakas back in 2008, and he fell to the Tigers at, what, 24 or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're right. I think something had to be done with the draft because of what was happening with it. But, and I think the draft always has to change. I don't think that they can keep the same set of rules because teams are smart, and they start gaming the system. And, you know, at some point, it's kind of like drug testing. You feel like the players are always ahead of the testing, and there's always going to be something. That's an argument you hear a lot. And I think it's kind of the same idea. Teams are always going to be ahead of the draft and finding the loopholes, and that's okay. It's not quite as big of a deal as steroids or anything like that. But, yeah, I think that there's going to have to be some tweaks made to close up the loopholes, and then teams will find new loopholes, and they'll make tweaks to that. And it's just a never-changing process the way I see it.
Yeah, I agree. Have you taken a time to look at their new top 20 Royals prospect rankings?
I have, yeah. It's interesting to me. I've got the top 10 pulled up right now, and obviously it's a click of the arrow to get to the next 10. So, yeah, Mondesi number one, I don't have an issue with. Zimmer two. I'll just read down the list real quick. Mondesi, Zimmer, Manaea, Dozier, Almonte, Finnegan, Jorge Bonifacio, Binford, Foster Griffin, and Chase Velo round out the top 10. So that seems about right to me. I think you can really make a case for any of the top four at number one. I don't think Almonte necessarily has a case at number one the way he's pitched this year in Wilmington.
Mm-hmm.
But any of those top four, I think, could be your number one prospect. None of them are terribly inspiring right now. But there's a lot of depth in the system. Not a lot of high-end depth, but a lot of depth.
No, I have no problem. It's interesting that Christian Benford, who I didn't even have rated on my top 20 going into this year, just because I don't think there was enough to know about him, really, going in. Just because when you read a scouting report on Christian Benford, it's not impressive. It's low 90s. It's the breaking ball is kind of iffy. The changeup's kind of iffy. But some of that stuff sounds like it's been refined. It looks better when I watch him on video. And I would probably put him ahead of Bonifacio, maybe even ahead of Finnegan, just because Finnegan's limited track record right now. Obviously, his track record, what he's doing at high A is extremely good.
It is 11 innings with three hits, no runs good. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you want three hits. I think all three hits have been eliminated, or two of the three hits have been eliminated with a double play. One walk that he's allowed, that was eliminated with a double play. So he's allowed four base runners, three of which have been eliminated with a double play. That's pretty good.
I think the Bonifacio Binford thing, and forgetting Finnegan, because I think that's just a matter of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that goes back to the production versus potential. Because, yeah, I think Christian Binford, his production is right. There's very few better right now. I mean, he had a 2.4 ERA in Wilmington. He's got a 2.15 ERA in his first five Double A starts. And he's still striking guys out. He's limiting walks. He's not giving up a ton of hits. All that stuff. But Jorge Bonifacio struggling at that same level, obviously different because he's an outfielder, not a pitcher, but struggling at that same level, he's rated higher. And I think it's because, I mean, which one of those two guys do you think is more likely to be an all-star in the big leagues?
Yeah, I don't.
Or has a better chance, I guess, to be an all-star.
Yeah, I guess Bonifacio, but I just don't see all-star, and he hasn't produced, and I liked what I saw a couple of years ago at Midwest League, but that's a couple of years ago now, and so
it's 2-3 bad years for him.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's kind of the same stuff. His swing path, usually it works better to right center field, which, you know, at the time I thought would work play very well at the K. I thought you were looking at maybe a less on base percentage type Billy Butler hitter is what I was thinking. But the strength and the power and the swings just never come along. And so that really hurts his value. The Royals,
he's only 21.
Yeah, he is. That's the thing. That's the thing with international guys, and that's kind of what I wanted to ask Jim about, is international guys, they're on the map for a long time, but it's like they just don't get rated that highly unless they are big-name signees. You don't see a guy just pop up. There's not too many pop-up international guys that just come out of nowhere and then are on a list and rated highly. And ultimately, the lists don't matter. If a guy performs, he'll get his way through. But a guy like Cuthbert, Bonifacio, they're still only 21. They're younger than Hunter Dozier. They're younger mm-hmm. than a lot of these guys that are rated higher. But it just seems that we've known them for so much longer that they get ticked down for that.
You mentioned Cuthbert. I want to touch on him real quick. He's kind of come alive, hasn't he, in the last three weeks down in Double-A?
He's shown a lot more pop lately. But now that with his positional value, it's really, unless he can play at second base, and they've given him one game at second base, unless he can play there, then his path to the majors is severely depleted as a first baseman.
Yeah, and he's off third base pretty much because of
Dozier.
Hunter Dozier, yeah. And so I think it's interesting. When they talked about moving him to second base, which, as you've said, they've only done very briefly, and I'm okay with waiting until next year to really get him in there as a second baseman. I think he could be a guy who you work with all offseason. You get him in a few games here and there, and then you work him in. But it's not like they talked about Dozier at second base when they drafted him. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at this guy, and I'm going, this is a behemoth of a man, and you want him to play second base? That's not happening.
No, his best, if he can't play third, he's got to be an outfielder.
Or a first baseman.
Yeah.
But Chesler Cuthbert, he's 6'1". Yeah, he's probably listed at 190. I would guess that's not exactly accurate. I would put him at probably 200 just by looking at him. But still, that size plays at second base. He's got some quick feet. He's not fast, but he has quick feet, if I remember correctly from watching him. And I could see him transitioning to second base. So if he can make that transition, you know, since June 18th, he's a .306 hitter with a .477 slugging percentage. As a second baseman, if he can make that transition, and I think he's probably athletic enough to give it a go, if he can do that, that's that plays.
Well, you watch a guy like Christian Colon, and I think Cuthbert probably has just as much foot speed as Colon does. Colon's
yeah.
pretty slow-footed guy as well. Similar bodies, I think, on both of them. Colon's probably a little bit slimmer or a little bit sleeker, I guess. Actually, since July 18th, after encountering a little injury and missing a week, Cuthbert in the last 10 games is hitting .371 with 1,064 OPS, and he's 1-for-2 tonight on Monday night when we record this. So he is coming along quite well. He's had a lot more patient approach for the whole season this year, mm-hmm. which is nice. Very positive out of him. That's something that kind of went away ever since his real good start in the Midwest League. So he's a guy that if a team was willing to trade for him and they think they can be a second baseman, I think he'd be a good part of a deal. And he's a good part for the Royals in that he's still young. He's 3 years younger than the level at 21, and he's at Double-A. And there's still some pop in there, obviously, with he's hit 28 extra base hits this year in under 90 games. So he's got a lot of pop, and he's definitely somebody to watch and push. I guess When would he be available, though? To push Infante out here in, what, 2 years?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
that's the problem that these because we've seen the same thing with Christian Colon this year. Christian Colon, all of a sudden, I don't know why, but the last 40 games is showing a lot of pop in his bat.
Yeah.
And so I don't – and he's probably going to be the benefit of this Danny Valencia trade in that he's probably going to get some time at third base. So it's really interesting. Is Christian Colon now, is he your super utility guy? I'd say probably. I was breaking down the salary of the team for next year, the projected payroll, and they're going to have cheap bench guys, real cheap, mm-hmm. to if they're going to want to have to do any contract flexibility at all. And so you got to have Christian Colon on your bench or Pedro Siriaco, and I think Colon's a better option than Siriaco.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Colon's power surge. Since he got sent back down, he's got a 720 slugging percentage. In 12 games.
Yeah, and I think his last 40 games or something, he's got, and I think he's gotten over 900 OPS if you count minors and majors in his last 40 games or so. It's weird. I mean, I'm not going to make any accusations, but that's weird. It just all of a sudden it popped up. I mean, it's.
Yeah, since May 31st, last 40 games, 356 batting average, 406 on base percentage, and 537 slugging percentage.
Yeah. And that includes his major league time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the guy's hitting. Can't complain. I think he's got one or two hits tonight. Or no, he's not in the lineup tonight. But no,
they pulled him from the lineup because he's coming up to replace Valencia on the big league roster.
Yeah,
so.
16 extra base hits in that time and walking more than he strikes out in that time. So something clicked in his game. I don't know what, but it's clicked, and maybe it's just a streak or whatever. But the Royals hopefully can take advantage of it.
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting to see what Colon can do down the stretch.
Yeah, definitely. The Royals, as I wrote today, they've got an opportunity, and hopefully they can take advantage of it in August in that they play a lot of weak teams. They play a lot of bottom feeders. Yes, they play the Oakland A's. They play the San Francisco Giants next month, but they got the Twins coming in, and they've got some other weak teams, a lot of weak teams this month.
Yeah, they have a chance. They have a chance here, and it's a lot of it's schedule-driven, as we talked about before the All-Star break.
Yep. So I think that'll wrap us up this week, David, and we'll be back. Hopefully, if you guys are out at the K Thursday, hopefully you can run into us.
We will all be there in our Royals garb.
Yes, in our Royals podcast glory.
Oh, yeah.
But on to better things and on to Royals victories and on to you guys next week.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.